We're here with Joe DeMaestri, and I just want to tell you before we start that this is for the Society for American Baseball Research and will be used by researchers and will also be submitted to the Cooperstown Hall of Fame. So I guess basically the way to start out is you had a 10-year major league career.
11, actually.
11.
Yeah,
that's right, 11. Yeah. And let's start from the beginning. I usually ask people, when was the first time you realized that maybe you might have a chance to play in the major leagues?
Well, I didn't really know when I would be able to play in the late major leagues. I had a good year, my fourth year in the minor leagues at Birmingham, in Double A. In fact, we had quite a team that year, and that was a Red Sox chain. And seven of us went to the major leagues from that club the next year. So, I was drafted. They had to move me to Louisville or higher, or they'd lose me, or could lose me in the draft. Of course, the draft was different in those days than it is today, as you know. But so I was drafted by the White Sox.
Now, what was the rule? They had to, after 4 years?
It was, I can't really remember.
They had to protect you. They had to put you on the major league roster after 4 years.
Either that or move you from one class to a triple A or something like that.
Now, who was the gentleman? I read somewhere that there was one player who really helped you with your hitting when you were in Birmingham. That kind of you credit for.
I'm trying to think in Birmingham.
Derringer? No, who was?
No, Pinky Higgins was our manager.
Maybe it was your first year in Chicago.
Well, Chicago was Gus.
Was it?
Thurniel.
Yeah.
Well, Gus and I became very close. In fact, he was like my big brother for me. He kept me on the straight and narrow. And I, to this day, we're very, very close. And I've always, really felt towards him for that.
Now, where did you go to high school?
Right here in Marin County, at Tamalpais High School.
And so you were drafted out of high school, senior year?
Yes, I was. I signed with the Red Sox. In fact, right after graduation, in 1947. 46, actually, and went to play Class C for 3 years, then went to Double A, and that's where I had a real good year, and the whole team had a really, really good year that year.
That was a pretty big jump back then, right?
It was. Yes, it was. It was, in fact, we played in that Southern Association at that time. There was Eddie Matthews was in it, and Don Little from the Giants. There was quite a few guys that went to the major leagues from that league.
Dick Littlefield was the name I was looking for.
Oh, Dick.
Helped you with your hitting.
Dick Littlefield, he was a pitcher. And, Dick, well, like I said, we were so much closer in those days, I think, than they are today. We were, and heck, we were just pretty young guys. And none of us had college backgrounds. I mean, everybody kind of went right out of high school and started playing ball for no money at all. And that's kind of the way it went.
And so then when you got drafted by the White Sox, then you played that first year? You went to spring training with them that first year and made the team?
Right.
Right,
in 1951 we trained in Burbank, or Pasadena, excuse me, Pasadena. And I made the club and was with them all that year.
And that was there. That wasn't too bad a ball club.
Actually, we ended up in fourth place.
Right.
It was the first time I think in 20 years that the White Sox had been in the playoffs, or in, not playoffs, which we didn't have, but in the money, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. And the manager was Paul Richards.
Paul Richards, right?
And you said about him that he was quite the taskmaster.
Oh, I mean, he was like three innings ahead of everybody else. He was so. Well, he was very hard to get close to. He wouldn't let you get too close to him.
He didn't hang out.
He didn't hang out, and I swear you could be talking to him, and if you turned around, he was gone. He never got to a point where you could really sit down and be real friendly.
Couldn't pin him down.
but he was an absolute genius, I thought, as a manager.
And I guess if you screwed up, he'd pull people aside and really chill out.
Yeah, he had no problem there either. He was very, very tough. Yeah.
And you had a lot of interesting characters on that team. Nellie Fox.
Well, Nellie. Nellie and I had a deal going for for most of our careers where who could hit the most home runs, and I think I hit 49 or something in my career, and I think he might have hit two or three, but it was just kind of one of those bats that bought him a cigar once in a while, and there again, another young guy had gone too quick.
And didn't some coach take him aside and teach him how to play shortstop?
No, you know, one thing I do remember about Nelly, he came to us from Philadelphia, I believe. He was at Philadelphia the year before, and I think it was my first year in '51, and we were down in Pasadena, and Doc Kramer was the first base coach, and they were getting ready to send him out because he wasn't hitting. He just wasn't hitting at all, and I'll never forget the night. Doc Kramer wanted some guys to stay after practice and shag balls. And, of course, I was a rookie. I was going to, you know, do anything I can to get in and make a good impression. And I did. And he was the one that took a bottle bat, the old bottle bats. And because Nelly, when he first started hitting, he stood in the batter's box like a normal guy would stand, like you see today, with feet spread and all that, and the bat back. He just took that bat and put it in his hands, put his feet close together, and just let him punch the ball. And from then on, the guy was a 300 hitter.
Do you think did he finally get into the Hall of Fame?
I don't think so.
No,
so I don't think he did. I don't think Nelly made it to the Hall of Fame.
Why do you think that is?
Well, you know, he wasn't a very flashy ball player. He was just a steady guy. Nelly used to field ground balls on one knee. You know, those are things that you don't see anymore. But that's the way he was. He didn't have a good arm. He wasn't really fast for a little guy. But he was tough. He just played the game the way it should be played.
So you platooned with him then?
Well, yeah,
and Chico Carrasquel.
And Chico Carrasquel. I played short mostly, and Nelly played second mostly.
What do you remember about Chico?
Well, Chico was a real good shortstop. Real, you know, strong arm, strong hitter, power. Spoke very little English. It was kind of a my first experience with guys who don't talk too much English. But we had Chico, and we had Louis Aloma. We had a couple of guys that you know, were from Caribbean and that area. But like you said, we had a real veteran pitching staff and ended up with a good year.
And then Bob Dillinger, I remember I read somewhere he's telling a story about him. What do you remember about him?
Well, Bob was a great cheater.
That's right.
Great cheater.
He was a cork in the bat before they corked the bat.
He did everything to a bat. I mean, the guy was amazing. One night, I remember they called him on it. He used to take the bats and he would have it so he would actually have a smooth face, but you couldn't tell. He would file it so that it was round all the way until it got to the hitting area. Then it was kind of flat. And it was done to perfection, believe me. And then the other thing he did, he used to groove them. Where the wood is pressed together, you could see he would groove it to make it real. So when it hit the ball, mm-hmm. it would really kind of jump. You know, he was a great line drive hitter. Super line drive hitter. And one night they called him on it at the plate, and he'd argue, and they're all looking at the bat, so he threw the bat away, and one of them grabbed another one. It was just as bad as the one he just threw away. But that was Bob.
He had done it to all the bats.
Oh, he every bat he had, I think.
Was and back then, it wasn't that big a deal? Or?
No, it just, it, you know.
They didn't suspend him or anything?
No. They didn't even stop, you know, didn't throw him out of the game. I mean, it was just they just made him throw the bat away.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, if that would happen today, he'd still be sitting on the sidelines somewhere.
And who else was on that? Look at the pitching staff. Billy Pierce,
yeah.
Ken Holcomb.
Right. Howie Judson.
Pierce was really the Pierce was best the, pitcher on that staff.
Yeah, Billy was. And, oh, we had Sol Roggeveen and Marvin Rotblatt. Mm-hmm. Sol Roggeveen had an excellent year that year for us.
Who's that now?
Roggeveen.
Oh, yeah. He was a 2.48 ERA. 11-7.
Yeah.
And then, so you played in 1951 for the White Sox, and then in 52 you got traded to the Browns.
Browns, right.
And went into that craziness.
Yeah, that was a very, very tough year as far as winning and losing ball games. I don't know. We lost 100-plus games. I don't know what we ended up with.
100, no, that year actually 64-90. Oh, that's 52. Well, finished seventh in the American League.
Yeah, it seemed like it was longer than that, more losses than that, but especially in that hot weather, those games were long.
And tell me about that team.
Well, the Rogers Hornsby was the manager, and probably the toughest guy I've ever met, and probably the most disliked.
Yeah, I heard all the players hated him.
Oh, I mean, it was we finally got him kicked out in Boston. And we begged Vec, and we had a big meeting and everything, and he came up, and he did. He fired him and made Marty Marion the manager. And but it was really, really a tough deal to play for him.
Can you remember an example of something he did that was really...
Well, he was... Of course, he wasn't crazy about the blacks, and he wasn't crazy about Satchel Paige, that's for sure. And, of course, Satchel was the only black player we had at that time. He thought that Jim Rivera and Clint Courtney, the catcher.
Old scrap iron.
Were the greatest things that hit the ball field. He said they're the only two guys he'd ever pay to see play ball. And I really can't really put anything to him, except I know that every game was a miserable thing out there, and just it really came to a head.
Well, didn't he try to find Satchel Paige $200 one time
in spring training?
And then he said he went to Bill Vec.
Oh yeah, yeah, and he said, in fact, it was like I remember that day it happened in Burbank. We were all out for a meeting. We were sitting out in the bleachers. He had a meeting every morning in spring training, and you had to come walk all the way across the field to get to the bleachers, and Satchel wasn't there yet. So here he comes. We're all sitting in the bleachers. We can see him coming. Now, how are you going to hide? You know, big Satch, he's kind of stooped over low, trying to sneak up, and he still had to come like 200 yards. And when he got there, that Hornsby lit into him and said, you know, you're fine, $200. And Satch just looked at him. He says, no, sir. He says I'm going to call Mr. Beck. And he did. And that was the end of that.
He never called him like the N-word or boy or anything.
No, I don't recall.
Stayed pretty professional, but yeah. You could tell there was animosity there.
Yeah, we played in San Francisco, and he wouldn't let me come home, and I just lived right across the bridge, and that started it as far as I was concerned.
Why wouldn't he let you go home?
You know,
he thought you were going to party or something?
I guess. I don't know.
Or just
and I was still
difficult.
A rookie. Let's face it. I was just I still wasn't playing regular because Marty Marion was a shortstop. Mm-hmm. And then when Marty became manager is when I really started playing more.
Mm-hmm. Well, they have you here 52 as the starter. I guess you started in 81 games.
Yeah.
186 at-bats.
Yeah, that was... like I said, that was after Marty kind of took over and just kind of semi-retired.
And one home run. Was that your first home run in the majors?
No.
You had one in 51.
I had the last day of the season off Ned Garber in 51. We played in St. Louis, and I hit a home run that day off Ned.
Now, was that the one where he hit the game-winning home run?
He hit the game-winning.
Later in the game?
Yeah, he won one, yeah.
The pitcher hit it?
Yeah. Yeah, Ned was a good
And that player. Was the Browns?
Yeah.
Okay. Now, was he there when you went there the next year?
Yes. Yeah, Ned was there.
Oh, wow. So you probably got a laugh out of that one.
Oh, yeah.
And then do you remember who the one you hit when you were with the Browns was against?
I don't. I really don't.
Did you hit any home runs off any Hall of Famers in your career? I usually get that info, but they didn't.
Let's see. I'm trying to think. hit him off Larson. Early win.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of who else. I had such my best days were against Washington. They had a pitching staff that I just loved to play them. And every time we played them, I felt so loosey-goosey against them, and I had pretty good days. They had Chuck Staub. I don't know if you remember Chuck
Staub.
Sure,
he's the one who gave up Mickey Mantle's 500 and whatever
foot. Right, in Washington. I could sit there and Chuck, I've talked to him since, of course, but I could have made a real living off him.
I wonder what your batting average was against the center of his lifetime. Probably 400.
It was good. I know that. And he just couldn't get me out. I mean, it was one of those things, you know. And every time he pitched, I just knew that I was hoping that we wouldn't get to him too quick. Because I'd like to have 2-3 shots at him. But I swear, I just ate him up.
Now, but, on the other end, who owned you as far as pitching?
Oh, God. You can name an awful lot of them, Ed. But there were some really, really tough guys to bat against. Reynolds.
Allie Reynolds.
Really tough. You know, the Yankee staff, outside of Reynolds that I can recall, in those when I was playing, I didn't mind batting against, like, Rashi or Whitey. In fact, I did pretty good against Whitey. I could hit left-handers pretty good, but Reynolds was just tough and mean. And you know, I don't care who you were. I mean, you could be hitting 0-0-1 and get a base hit off Reynolds, and the next time up, down you'd go. He was tough, and early win was another one. I was just talking about the home run I hit off him in Kansas City. He'd come in, he had 25 scoreless innings. He was starting to get, I was leading off. I hit a home run off him, lead off the game. I says, oh, God. Because I knew he watched me go around the bases. So the next time up, he threw me a knuckleball. I hit it right past his ear. And that was it. The third time it was.
He punked you.
Boom. That and I knew it was coming. I mean, there was no ifs, ands, or buts with Early.
Now on that Browns team, I mean, did you interact very much with Satchel Paige? I'm sure everybody asked you about Satchel Paige.
Oh yeah, God. I mean, Satchel, you know, Satchel was a show in himself. He was one of the nicest guys that you ever want to talk to, and one of the funniest. Without trying to, I knew. He was a pretty good comedian himself. I mean, but he could jerk you around a little bit. But he was funny. And, you know, we some of those road trips on the trains and stuff that we took were just hysterical. But you know, he I don't know if you ever heard the story about him catfishing. He used to go catfishing.
No.
We'd be there when we were home in St. Louis. They would go out and set these trot lines all the way across the river.
Mm-hmm.
Bait them, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, I didn't know that type of fishing. We don't have that out here.
No.
But I heard people talk about it. Then, then they'd go out the next day and pull the lines in. Well, they had these catfish. They were that, you know, 4 feet long, 5 feet long. Geez, we come into the park one night and here in the showers about 4 of these things. He brought them in and threw them in the shower. Oh, geez. But that's the kind of stuff that Saj did. Then they bought him the chair, the lounge chair, and he had his girlfriends. He used to come to a game in St. Louis. Now, it would be 110 degrees for a day game, and these colored gals would come in with these big fur coats on, and they had the booze in little perfume bottles, and they'd slip them over because it was just a fence, you know. The seats were here, and, mm-hmm. and his chair was right up against the. Mm-hmm. thing where the bullpen was, and they would slip him the gin or vodka, but I'm sure it was gin, and he'd sit there and drink a few of those. Then they'd call him, and he would throw about 2 pitches, come in, and Bob Bowman was our trainer. Bob was a great guy and a great trainer, and Satch would get on the mound and he'd start burping, and he would get these terrible stomach cramps, and Bob Bowman had to come out, take his fist, put it right in the pit of his stomach, and start pushing until he burped.
Huh.
Then he was fine.
Huh.
He was ready to go. And boy, and he could go. He did that in Washington one night. We had three men on. And they brought Satch in, and he kept telling them, he says, oh, I got terrible pains, terrible stomach. And Bob sat there on the mound and kept pushing and pushing until he burped. He struck out three guys in a row. But that was Satch. That's the way he operated.
Okay, so that was 52. And then what about Bill Vack? What do you remember about him?
Oh, Bill. You know, Bill, you couldn't play for a nicer guy. I mean, this guy was such a player's owner. It was incredible. And he used to take the families on barbecues, and it was just constant. And then Bill always had the shirts. Remember the collar, white, mm-hmm. open collar with short sleeve,
right.
white shirts? In fact, I think they named the shirt after him.
Yeah.
And he used to bring his boxes to everybody, a dozen shirts to everybody, you know. And stuff.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. Bill was incredible, absolutely incredible. Just a nice, nice guy. And I think he lived right there in the stadium. I think he had a place upstairs at Sportsman Park and where he stayed. And I really, really enjoyed playing for Bill.
Now, did he have, when you were there in 52, did he pull any of his stunts? The midget game was in
51. Well, that was before. Yeah, that was 51, I believe, the midget. Because Bob Kane pitched against,
right.
pitched against him. But in 52, the only thing that I can remember that he probably pulled, they at least they accused him of it, is when we'd play a team like Detroit or New York, and like Boston, Detroit, Cleveland, New York were the four top teams in those days in the American League. And you're playing a tough team coming in. The tarp had holes in it. So we'd get rained out or wetted out because the tarp couldn't hold water off the field. And they accused him of putting, you know, the wetting the field down with the tarp with the mm-hmm. holes in it and stuff like that. We'd have to call a game. Because we weren't going so good, and in those days we really weren't going so good. Mm-hmm. So he'd rather play a doubleheader later in the year and take our chances.
Well, didn't they accuse him of moving the fences in and out too? Or?
You know, it could have, but I don't recall any of that. No.
Now this wasn't the year that he got the psychiatrist to talk to the players. That must have been the year before.
No.
Seems like all the craziness happened at 51.
Yeah, because. No, we never had that problem.
So then in 53, you started a seven-year stint with the Athletics in
right.
Philadelphia and Kansas City.
Right.
And what was your first impression when you went to Philadelphia?
Well, there again, my whole career was playing behind shortstops or playing for shortstops. That was Eddie Juice was the shortstop then. And I knew that I wasn't going to, be playing right away anyway. And it, as it turned out, he blew his knee out in May or something like that in 53. And he was through. And so that's when I kind of took over and started playing.
Well, that was probably batting average your best year.
Yep.
255.
Yeah, and there again, it was... Eddie became the manager the next year, 54.
Jimmy Dykes was the manager.
Jimmy was our manager in 53. Yeah.
How was he?
Oh, Jimmy was a great guy. Great guy to play. Well, Eddie was fine too, but Eddie was more a little more gung ho. Jimmy was kind of laid back, you know, the old school type, and he was just a super guy to play for. No problems. Never give the players any problems.
And Connie Mack was long gone by then, right?
Well, Connie was around, but he wasn't really involved. His sons were, Roy and Earl.
Right.
They were the ones that were involved with the club at that time.
And how were they to get along with?
Roy was very good. Roy was very nice. Earl was kind of a character.
Weren't they kind of cheap, though? Didn't you have a winning streak and they promised you something and then you didn't get it?
Well, that was Kansas City.
Oh, that was Kansas City.
Yeah, that happened in Kansas City. But... Speaking about cheap, we sold Allie Clark to pay the salaries that year for I think we sold him to New York for $25,000. In fact, Ellie, I've seen Ellie a couple of times, and he's talked. We've talked about it. Mm-hmm. But yeah, they of course they, you know, we weren't drawing anybody, mm-hmm. and they were they just didn't have the money, I guess.
Drew, you had 362,000 fans at you.
Isn't that something?
In Shy Park. What did you think of Shy Park?
Well, the park I enjoyed. I liked the park. That was there was nothing wrong with Shy Park. In fact, it was great for me because I lived only about two blocks from there, so I could walk. I didn't have to worry about having a car or anything. But we had a chance to go through the new stadium, not the new one, but the veteran stadium last 2 years ago. Went back for a reunion thing with Juiced and Eddie and Gus Erniel, and so I got to see that ball.
Bobby Shantz.
Bobby? Nice.
Was Bobby there too?
Bobby, yeah. That was one heck of a pitcher. One heck of a pitcher for a little guy. Boy, he had a great year in, what, 52? 24 and 4 or something like that.
Yeah.
And then they struck those three guys out in a row, and the All-Star game got rained out.
And then what about Pete Suter, 37 years old?
Yep.
Eddie was 37. You had some veterans.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there was a lot of veterans hanging around in those days with that club. Peter, he was just like a machine. I remember him, he was so fluid in everything he did, and nothing bothered him. You know, just when you saw Pete, that's what you saw. You might see it tonight, you'll see it tomorrow, you'll see it Sunday. Doesn't make any difference. That was Pete. No ups and downs. Geez, he had a heck of a year that one year. I don't know if it was 53 or 54, but the All-Star, I think he was well over 300 in the All-Star game or something. Where he started out like just a house of fire, but I don't know what he ended up with. And I can't.
Now, what year was this?
It was either 53 or 54. It was 2 years ago.
And we're talking about Pete?
Pete, yeah.
He batted 286 and 53. That's okay, here.
That's got to be it. That's got to be the one where he just jumped out and was. That was a good average for him. That was a real solid.
Now is this? I also somewhere else I heard that you got it. That like Alex Kellner and those guys got you into fishing.
Oh yeah, well Alex, yeah we used to go fishing on our off days and stuff like that, and we used to go shooting groundhogs over in. about 20, 30 miles out of Philadelphia. There was some farmlands out there. And Alex was a big game hunter, him and his brother, Wolf. And so finally, that winter after the season, Gus and I went with him and his family down to Mexico. I mean, down to no man's land.
Yeah, where'd you go? Do you remember?
I don't remember the name of it, but I tell you, we didn't see anything but an Indian tribe.
Mm-hmm.
And we took these longboats. We were pulling longboats, and we were going through creek beds. And it took us 17 hours from Tucson.
Wow!
To get there. I mean, we weren't going very fast. I mean, I'm telling you, we were in places unbelievable.
And what kind of fish were you fishing for?
Oh, we caught grouper. We caught everything up to shark, and it was gorgeous. I mean, everything. Whole trip was really, really an experience, but that was their life. That's all they did. That's all they did.
So you played how many years in Philly then?
2 years.
2 years.
53 and 54.
And then when did you start to know? When did everybody start to know they were going to be moving?
Well, we didn't really know. Well, we started hearing rumors at the end of 54, but I don't think many of us paid too much attention to it, and I found out we played a exhibition game when we'd come home in Modesto. The Elks used to have an exhibition game, and he'd get all the this friend of mine used to be with the Elks over in Modesto. He would get all the major leaguers, get a team of major leaguers and a team of coast leaguers, and we'd play each other. And like Mike Garcia played with us, and we had a real good ball club, good games. And we were coming home. I was coming home with my folks that night, and it was on the radio. Came over on the radio. That's where I heard it, that they'd sold the team to Kansas City. And needless to say, that, you know, that was like, that was like going to heaven for my wife. It was tough.
Yeah, because you said that you didn't really do that much in Philly. You just, you didn't have a car, so you just went where people had cars.
And you know, it was really tough. I thought on them, on the women, and because most of us had wives and families, you know, young kids and everything. And it was different. The people were different.
Why do you think the fans were so mean and so?
You know, I remember when Gus broke his shoulder and they booed him. I remember when we took him off the field. And I mean, that was Dario Lodigiani tells some great stories about Philadelphia too. Dario, I've been with him in a couple of things, and he said, hell, he's had shoes thrown at him. He said, you know, I mean, he's, and they, you know, today when you listen to guys talk even about football and any of it, when you're talking about Philadelphia, you're talking about something else.
Right.
They all say the same thing.
Yeah.
They kind of laugh when they talk about it. You know?
What did W.C. Fields say? I forget what he said.
Yeah. Well, I know they boo Santa Claus and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
You know? But
please don't bury me in Philadelphia.
Yeah.
But didn't they pour beer on the wives and stuff?
That was going on all the time. Yeah.
So did your wife come to the games?
My wife didn't go to a lot of games. She did to a few. No, she really had a tough time there. Yeah. Let's see, 53. She didn't. I don't think she came back in 53. She came back in 54 because the kids were in school and she didn't want to take them out. So it was probably better off.
Because I remember in the earlier years, they said Connie Mack traded some guy to spare him from getting killed by the Philadelphia fans.
Well, I wouldn't doubt it. That, a lot of people, when you tell them stuff like that, they don't believe it. But they were really, really.
I mean, did they heckle, or was it just more booing?
They were hostile.
They yelled stuff at you about, you know.
Yeah.
Your
and I'll tell you, Chicago wasn't much better. I remember when we were in Chicago, my first year, Eddie Robinson bought a convertible, a new convertible, and he had a place you could drive in and park, you know, for the players.
Mm-hmm.
He came out that night. You should have seen that car. They had ketchup, mustard all over the top. I mean, it was just unbelievable. This is our home. Those are our fans.
That's terrible.
Oh.
And so when you moved to Kansas City, they were really nice.
Oh, well.
They were happy to have a
team. They didn't care, you know, if you lost 200 games at that time, in the beginning. They just wanted baseball. And they came from all those. They had like 7 states they could draw from around that area.
Mm-hmm.
And you could go in that parking lot and just look at the license plates, and they just came from all over. And they packed that place. God, they would barbecue pigs and bring them up, and you could see them. They'd have all the barbecues up in the top, you know, cutting the meat. Oh, it was like being reborn. And I loved the ballpark.
You know, what was the name of the park?
Oh, God, it was, that was municipal. I think it was municipal park, yeah. And now it's a big vegetable garden.
Mm-hmm.
Something we drove by when we went back for a reunion. But it was great. And Arnold Johnson was a super, super guy, super owner.
Now, I'm sure you also, everybody wants to ask you about Vic Power.
Oh, Vic.
When did you start? Now, what year did you first play with him?
Well, Philadelphia.
In 52?
No, it must have been 54. Okay, yeah, because he came from, I think he was in the Yankee chain or somewhere. I forget, anyway. Well, Vic, you know, if you're talking about athletes, Vic was one hell of an athlete. But Vic had his own style of baseball. And you had to get your style to work with his style, and that became a real problem for a while.
Like he drifted across the bag.
Yep,
he wasn't there when you threw it.
Exactly, he was you when you hit Vic, you hit him on the run, and you go in a hole and come up, and you hope you could find the bag first, because he's on the move. All you're seeing is a target moving. And the guy was great. I mean, he would make the play for you, but it got very real tiresome.
Did anybody tell him that was more difficult?
God. It was like talking to a brick wall. And the guy was a good hitter, bad ball hitter, but good hitter. You know, he could do it all. And it's just that he had that style of...
He was very rebellious.
Oh, God. The maddest I ever got was playing. He played second base one day. We had, I forget, second baseman hurt or whatever, and so Boudreaux was the manager. And Boudreaux put him on second. We're playing, and guy hits me a ground ball. He played second just like he played first. When you come up for the double play, mm-hmm. you look, he's not there yet. Mm-hmm. He's still coming. And he takes the ball, touches the bag, and leaps in the air to turn the throw. And of course, this particular day, in this particular play, we were in Cleveland. And he did it. We didn't get the double play. And after the inning was over, I had never done this in my life, I swear. But I took my glove, and I walked over to Boudreaux, and I handed it to him, and I said, "You go play with him." That's all I could say. I mean, it was bad enough at first base, but at second base, I mean, there was no excuse for stuff like that.
Did you guys ever get in an argument?
No. Vic and I, we got along great. We did. But, you know, I knew he wasn't going to change. So,
do you think, did he get heckled very much in Philadelphia for being black?
No, but he got in a lot of trouble in Kansas City for it because he was going around with his white girl.
White girl, I heard, yeah.
Yeah. And in Kansas, mm-hmm. And I'm sure that they called him in, and you know, I don't know how far it went. I don't know.
Well, he said that they said it was okay to. They said they were having a picnic or something, and they said you could bring your wives or girlfriends, and then he brought her, and they freaked out.
Yeah.
He said most of the players didn't mind.
Well,
it was the management.
Yeah. Well, it was the management.
There wasn't very many interracial dating at that time at all.
Oh no, and to be honest with you, I didn't know he was even doing it mm-hmm. until we heard about it. Mm-hmm. Until finally through the grapevine it came back down. Mm-hmm. And as far as the players went, there was no problem. We didn't have any the only problem that I can remember on our club, and if there were some, I don't remember them or I never heard of them. When we had Tim Thompson, the catcher. We got Timmy from Montreal or somewhere, and he joined us, and Vic was playing first base, and the guy hit a pop-up behind the plate. Tim throws his mask away, and he's ready to catch the ball, and here comes Vic, and just plows, makes the catch, but plows into Thompson, and just knocks him. And Tim was a real tough guy, really strong and tough, and he just, it was as close to a fight that I've seen in your own, on your own team, as probably I've seen since I've been playing. And there again, they had to call him into the office. Boudreaux had to call him into the office and everything, and that was, I guess they settled it. But that was Vic. My God, he was, and when he ran, he was a big guy. You know, he had really put together, and he ran full bore when he came. He was just going to take over, and that's the way he played the game.
And I got to hear the story about the time that he almost got the whole team lynched by the CHP.
Oh, boy. That's my favorite story. I've told that story, Ed. If I've told it once, I've told it 200 times. And it really... We played I believe we were playing Detroit in Florida in spring training. And, of course, they had... Gas stations and the restaurants had black and white bathrooms. And we were coming back. It was like 5:30 at night. And the blacks couldn't get off the bus when we stopped the restaurant, so we would get takeout for them. You know, we had Hector Lopez and Suitcase Simpson. And I don't forget it. We were sitting in the back of the bus. And we had a case of beer. and I'm sure, as I recall, after we finished the case, guys were throwing the cans out the window. So we're coming through Florida on our way back to West Palm Beach, and we stop at a gas station, and guys get out, and we go to the restroom, get a coat or whatever. Well, number one, Vic goes into the white restroom, and the guys told him, "Hey, Vic, you know you can't do this. You're not supposed to do this." Well, they had a young kid about 18, 19 years old who was at the was running the gas station, and we knew you could see him. He was watching Vic, watching him like a hawk. Well, Hector and Suitcase Simpson never got off the bus, so we get back on, and Vic had bought a Coke, and it was a deposit, 10-cent deposit on it. And somebody said, the kid said something about, "Hey, that guy never paid me the 10 cents for the bottle." Well, somebody said something to Vic. "Hey, Vic, you owe him 10 cents. So he turned around and he threw the dime at the kid. Just, you know, tossed it at him. Of course, it hit him and fell down. Well, we never thought of it anymore. We get on the bus.
Did he do it maliciously? Or?
Well, kind of like, you know, not... Maybe somebody would say it was maliciously. As I recall, it was just... He just tossed it at the kid and just kind of hit him with it. We get on the bus, but I remember we had a kid who just joined us. And I'm not sure if his name. His name was Davis. And the kid was—he was studying to be an attorney. He was a pitcher, I believe. Anyway, he was sitting right in the front seat. We're all in the back, and I'm sitting back there with Lopez and Gus, and we got the beer. So now we take off. We're about halfway home, and throwing the damn cans out the window. Well, about 10, 15 minutes go by, and all of a sudden we see this red light. Bus pulls over. Cop comes on. Just one cop. Looks around. And he says, "Everybody, who are you looking for, officer?" He says, "I'm looking for the blackest one." Just like that. Well, now, Vic is sitting way in the back. And it's... I remember Gus and him saying, "Hey, Vic, just keep your mouth shut." The guy hadn't come back yet. He was still in the front of the bus. Now he comes back, and this kid who had just joined us starts talking to the policeman. You know, "What do you, you know, this and that."
Is he black? Davis?
No. And he kind of smoothed the police officer down. And so the cop finally... He held us for about 15 minutes. He never did get back to Vic. So he said, "Well, okay. You know," he said, "but, you know, this and that happened, and just want to let you know," and all that. This guy was not too happy at the service station. Okay. Well, we figured that was the end. The cop turns around, heads back. Man, we hadn't gone another 20, 30 minutes. Here they come. I mean, it was like... Cox's army. They were plainclothesmen. These guys, you talk about rednecks, they were in t-shirts with 45s. And it was hot. But they had these guns strapped, no uniform type. They all got out, they got us out, and we had our hands on that bus, every one of us. And they went right after Vic. This kid, when they went back and told him, the kid said, "No, I want him." Well, this kid says, this kid with the attorney says, "We can't let him take Vic because we may not see this. We may not see this guy again." So he said he talked to one of the top cops there. He says, "Well, what kind of bail or what can we put down for him or whatever, you know?" And the guy says, $250. Well, Jesus, half of us.
That's a lot of money.
Yeah. Well, the reason this kid had most of it was they had just paid him to come to join us, and they had gave him his meal money and all this expense money. So he poured up the money, and we put in a few of them until we got the $250. And then they said that he's got to come back. So when we got back, Harry Kraft was sitting in the bar. We pulled in. Told Harry, "Well, we had an attorney. There was an attorney who used to come down to the games all the time, follow us around, you know." And we told him, and so said, well, he said, I'll take Vic and I'll go back to Dade County or wherever it was.
Straighten it out.
So I don't know what it ever cost him or whatever happened, but I'll tell you, that second one was scary because these guys were, they just had us and they had the guns out, you know, and they certainly knew who we were. I mean, it wasn't like this was a bus that they, you know, was dealing drugs or something. And man, oh man. You know, I can almost still see those guys with those damn white T-shirts on, sweating, huge.
Reminds me of Broderick Crawford in, you know, where he played the old Southern hick, yeah, the sheriff.
Yeah, exactly,
you know?
Exactly.
You get stuck there, you never know if you get out.
I tell you, yep.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have given them a dime's chance because they were hopping mad.
Hmm. And were the Phillies quicker to integrate, or were they late to integrate?
I'm trying to think who.
Vic Power was the first black player, right? Or was it Satchel?
No,
Satchel didn't play for the Phillies.
No. God, who was it? I'm trying to think with Philadelphia. Because I don't think when we played them, when we were in Philly, that they had any.
They didn't. Get it until they were in Kansas City.
Yeah.
Okay, so then you played in Kansas City for...
Flamingo freak.
Flamingos.
We
and
got
pugs.
Flamingos. We
oh,
got,
look at all those flamingos.
Yeah.
Wow. So then you got traded in a very famous trade, right?
Yeah. It was the winter of '59. Of course, Roger Maris was also with us in Kansas City,
mm-hmm.
And I was about ready to call it quits.
Really? Why?
Yeah. Well, we had started a business out here. My dad had started a business.
Doing what?
We had the Budweiser distributorship. And
all the Italians. They seem to own all the alcohol. Like in San Jose, they're all Italian names. I don't know what it is.
Yeah, I can tell you who the distributors were around here, and they were all Italian.
I know, and that's
everyone. Yeah. But anyway, yeah. And I, you know, I figured I had 9 years. And, you know, I was, well, when I got out, I, as you know, I decided this. The Yankees call me. And, of course, I knew about the trade, and they knew also that I might not go. So I got a phone call one day, and they said, look, we want you to come. We want you, to be the reserve. Well, I knew exactly what they wanted, and that was fine with me. And it was an opportunity. I figured, you know, let's face it, who's going to beat the Yankees? There weren't too many teams that were really going to beat them. And I figured this is a real good shot for me if I could, you know, just do halfway decent for him. And so I kind of talked it over with my wife and everything, and I decided to go back. And I'm certainly glad I did. You know, when I got out, I was 30. I stayed there the 2 years, and I was 33 years old. And, you know, it's amazing because I could feel my body didn't want to go much more. It really, really didn't. And the toughest thing was the fact that I wasn't playing, because it's so tough to stay in shape. And that's what I found.
Was it your eyes, your legs?
No.
Your arms?
It wasn't my arm, and I never had a problem with my arms or my eyes. But it was just the fact that you felt like you couldn't move like you used to be able to move. And I'm sure that makes sense, too, because I was a lot younger. But playing every day, once I got in shape when I was playing, I had no problem. I mean, there was no problem staying in shape. But when I wasn't playing, and I was trying to stay in shape, it was a whole different ballgame. And it was just real tough for me.
Now, did you, prior to getting traded to the Yankees, did you announce your retirement?
I didn't announce it, no. No, but I had talked to a couple of players, and you know, and word gets around, and then when I got the call from New York, and I told Roy Hamey, I said, well, you know, Roy, I said, I've been thinking about coming home and going into business and all that, and he made a, you know, a lot of sense to me with what I could do, and that they wanted me there. And so I said, well, I'll talk to my family and I'll get right back to you, which I did. And I talked to my wife and I called him back the same night.
Now, what was your relationship with Maris prior to that? Did you know him pretty well? Or?
Roger and I became very good friends. We really hit it off. We ended up in the same business with the Budweiser. Yeah. We ended up Roger was a type of guy that, you know, I could be around and I could feel comfortable with, because Roger had a kind of a funny way about him. He wasn't outgoing. He was very tough to talk one-on-one on if he didn't know you. And some of the where Roger got himself into mixed matches once in a while, he didn't know how to get his point over. He would say things that sounded a little borderline.
Could be misconstrued.
Absolutely.
Even though he didn't mean it.
Oh, no, absolutely. You know, Roger, I thought, was a great guy.
So, I mean, his communication skills weren't that great.
But Mickey loved it. Because Mickey was sitting over here, and they were, you know, they were after Roger, because Roger was the guy hitting the home runs. Or so was Mickey, but Mickey would say, well, don't go talk to Roger. And he'd laugh. He'd sit there and laugh. And then Roger had 50 guys around him. You know, he'd be inside the locker, and they couldn't get out. And these guys would throw questions at him, and you could... Some of the answers he gave, you'd sit there and go, geez, you know, I wish he hadn't said that. Or,
right.
And that was Roger's biggest fault. But outside of that, he had such a great year that year that it was really something to watch.
And they got Don Larson too, right?
They got Larson.
Yeah.
Yeah, Kansas City. Yeah. Yeah, Larson, they got kind of the outfielder, Seabird. Norm Seaburn, and they got Thornberry, because it was 11 guys, I think. It was 5-6 or 6-5. I can't remember which way it went.
Thornberry had all his success, had all his notoriety with the Mets.
Yeah, right. Yeah, right.
Now, why do you think, and this is a big question, I'm sure you hear this all the time, you know, in retrospect now, people look back at the relationship between the Athletics and the Yankees, and a lot of people have said that essentially during those years, the A's were just a, kind of a farm club. They were like the 4A,
sure,
if you would.
Sure.
Farm club for the Yankees. What do you say about that?
Well, you know, I can understand the way people felt then. But, you know, I think it's almost not like it is today with New York, because there's a whole different situation going on money-wise and everything else. But if you look at today, when the Yankees want somebody, they get them. Today.
Oh, sure.
They go out and buy them.
Mm-hmm.
It was no different in those days, except that nobody else would deal with the Yankees.
Right.
So, and we needed players, too.
Mm-hmm.
So if we could get, you know, we get Enos Slaughter, mm-hmm. and then Enos would go back to New York, mm-hmm. stuff like that, I guess, I why not?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Cleveland's not going to deal with you, or Boston's not going to deal with you. And you're fighting for a pennant in those days, just like you're fighting for them now. Only today, it's the money buying it, doing it.
Right.
You know, not the
trades,
not the lower minors.
Right.
So, you know, I never thought of it that way before, until every year it gets more and more so. Mm-hmm. You know, Steinbrenner just opens up the wallet and let's go see. My God, he's got a salary, what, $170 million or something?
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
But I knew back then some of the other teams were frustrated by it, because they figured...
Well, absolutely.
They used to say the A's.
Absolutely. You're right. You're right.
I'm sure you know a guy named Gus Triandos.
Oh, Gus.
Yeah.
Oh, I played with Gus.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I interviewed him, and he said that he played for Baltimore Orioles, and he said had the Orioles gotten Roger Maris rather than the Yankees, they would have won one of those pennants in there.
Yeah, because they had a great pitching staff then, too.
Yeah.
No, Gus and I were in Chicago together.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that's...
He is so fun to talk to.
He's guy. Another character.
Yeah.
He is really funny.
He says it's kind of frustrating now, because he gets calls all the time from sports writers and it's usually related to when somebody dies, like when Hoyt Wilhelm died. Yeah. You know, Castellanos caught his no-hitter.
Right.
Yeah. And they called him, and he says, yeah. Oh, damn it. And yeah, he's really colorful, fun to talk to. But he said that had they gotten Maris, which they were trying to, I guess, they would have won the pennant that year.
Yeah, I don't doubt it. I really don't.
I skipped 57, though. I wanted to ask you about being in the All-Star game.
Well, unfortunately, I didn't play. And it was two of us didn't play, Roy Sievers and I. Had it been kind of the rules today, we'd probably gotten a game, because I think they almost have to play everybody, or they...
Yeah.
We could have played
it. But they changed that rule this last year.
They changed it. I know it. But, it was interesting. But there again, it was one of those things that we flew from Kansas City to St. Louis. That's where the game was. Played the game and flew home. I mean, it was over. Mm-hmm. Today it's a four-day deal.
Right. You know,
they got the home run thing. They got the parties. They got this and that. So, today is just unbelievable.
Do you remember what happened in the game?
I know we won. It was the first game we'd won. The American League had won in a long time, I understand. But I remember Mays, playing. And I remember Musial. Of course, we had Williams, Mantle. We had a pretty good team, too. But I honestly don't remember the game that well.
Were you disappointed that you didn't get to play?
I wasn't disappointed so much at first when the game was first over. I think as time went on, I know that we could have gotten in the game somewhere. And certainly Roy Sievers, who was a great hitter, should have gotten in the game somewhere.
Even who was the manager? Casey?
Casey, yeah. And in fact, I almost beat McDougal out in the voting for shortstop. We were very close. It was just nip and tuck between him and I. And of course, if I had, then I would have played.
Right.
But anyway, it was fun to be there. It was certainly an honor to be picked. That's about the only way you can look at it. Would I have liked to have played? Absolutely. It was fun.
So when you got to the Yankees, were you? I guess you were pretty much a veteran by then, so you didn't really. What didn't?
Yeah,
you weren't awed by it.
No. I knew exactly what what. I think I knew what they were looking for, and I found out the first day in spring training, when I was Casey had the meeting. I was sitting there, and I was surrounded by Scourin and McDougal, Yogi, and they came over and they said, "Remember one thing: when you go in that game, you're playing with my money." And that was all they told me.
Who said that? All of them.
They just all reiterated that was the way it was, and that's all they said to me. And I knew these guys well because I had played against them for 9 years.
No, I had heard it was real cliquish there, though. That veterans hung out with the veterans, rookies hang out with the rookies. They kind of set it up that way in the locker room, or
no? I didn't. So much? I really didn't think it was that way, Ed. If it was, I certainly didn't know about that, or wasn't aware of it. We pretty much mingled. I mean, everybody.
And so in '60, you got right away. You're on a team that was winning. When you got in the World Series,
well, that I knew that was the end of it for me, because I had already told Huck.
And that was 61 though. I'm talking about the 60 year before, right?
Oh, that was 61. Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, 60.
Yeah,
you,
60. Yeah. Yeah.
You guys lost to the Pirates.
Yeah. Yeah, that was.
And you didn't. You got to play in that.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
You're saying the reason you didn't play in 61?
Yeah,
is how
I thought
you were going to
retire. Yeah. But no, 60. When we had that last game, and I was supposed to be in when Tony got hit. I was supposed to be in at that, because when Casey did the last half of the season, he would put Tony in left. I played short, and Yogi would come out. And when we were in Pittsburgh that day, he was. if Yogi wasn't coming to bat, because he told me, he said, you go down and warm up, you're going in. And I'm warming up down the sideline, and he says, wait a minute. He says, Yogi's got another bat. So he says, we'll wait till after Yogi bats then. Well, that's the inning that Tony took the shot in the throat. And so that was kind of a
bummer.
Oh.
And then Yogi, you roomed with Yogi, and Yogi predicted the night before that he was going to hit that.
Oh, yeah. He said off of
Elroy
Pace. Yeah, Yogi was amazing. He was kind of telling me exactly what was going to happen. It was like being in another world. He said, I know exactly what's going to happen today. And he did. I mean, he did hit the home run. But that was quite a series.
Yeah, it was a heartbreaker. You guys had it won, and they took it away.
Unbelievable.
I mean, they beat you 2-1, and you beat them 11-0.
Yeah, 13 or 16 of them.
Yeah.
I mean, we set every record there was, I think.
But you got to play. You got four at-bats.
Yeah, I got...
You got a hit?
I got hit the first time up. I got playing four games, I think, something like that. But, yeah, it was...
Now, were you on the roster in 61 for the World Series?
Yeah.
Oh, so you just... You
were on the bench. But I knew that... When they called me when we won the pennant, and then before we started the series, Cincinnati, they called me in the office. Said, what are you going to do? What's your plans? Are you going to come back next year? We want you. They said, we want you back. And I had made up my mind early on that I wasn't going to come back. So that just. We really didn't need anybody then because we kind of breezed through that series.
Didn't that kind of tick you off a little bit? You'd be nice to talk, put you in one.
Yeah, I could. Yeah, there again.
You won four games to one, right?
We had no. There was no problem as far as winning the ball games or anything. But
were you the only non-pitcher that didn't play in that World Series?
I really don't remember. I just don't remember.
They said Houck was a... kind of tough too.
He could be
ex-military guy.
Oh yeah, he could be. He was a players type manager, and he could be real tough. Yes, he could.
Did you notice in the time that you were in New York? Could you relate to what they talk about how tough the press is and being under a spotlight and that being pretty much the ultimate that it gets.
You could see it. I could see it every day, especially when you ran into what Roger had to go through. And
do you remember Dick Young? And do you remember Leonard Coppett there?
Leonard Coppett, yeah. I remember Leonard. I remember Dick Young. He was tough. He was really tough.
I heard he kind of had the run of the thing there. He, he'd write what he wanted, and then you'd have to deal with it later.
I don't doubt that because he just watching him operate with some of the guys there and some of the stuff, the questions. I tell you, I was glad I didn't have to worry about him too much. But Coppett was a good guy.
Yeah, he just died recently.
He was. He was, and I'll tell you, they had a guy there that was really good. Richter? What the hell was his name? Gil McDougall and I had dinner with him in Pittsburgh one night after one of the games, and he told us he says the one thing he says it was about Maris. He said I'll never sit and write something about a guy. Roger was making these statements, and he knew, as a writer, that Roger didn't mean what he was saying. And that's what he was trying to explain to Gil and I. He says, I wouldn't touch that. He says, I just wouldn't print that, because I know he doesn't mean it. I know he knows the way it sounds, it's coming out completely different than the way he...
And he knew he could probably hurt him by printing
it.
He was
the only guy, and Gil had told me, and a couple other guys told me, that he was the one guy that they all liked very much because of that fact that he would not print, get on a guy's case or stuff like that.
Well, back then it was a little different than it is now because the reporters ate with the team. The team. They went. The team paid for them to go on trips, and you know.
Yeah.
So they were more reluctant to write stuff, bad stuff. Did you know Gil McDougall pretty well?
Yes, Gil and I played against each other in high school. He went to Commerce here in San Francisco.
Did he? A lot of people say he got kind of ruined because after he hit Herb's score, it affected him greatly.
I never talked about that. I did talk to Gil since that, but then you know he lost his hearing completely, and now I hear he's got it. They did perform that operation on him. I was back in New York, I guess 2 years ago, and Moose and those guys were telling me that he
where was that, in Atlantic City?
Yeah, not Atlantic City. We were in New Jersey.
Newark. Yeah.
And that he was, he had recovered his hearing.
If they're going to do these baseball reunions, why do they have to pick a city like Newark? It's
so far for us to go, you know.
What they're doing now, I don't know if you ever get any of those, is those cruises.
Well, you know, I've never really gotten any of those.
Yeah, I bet you in the future they have one, the Philadelphia A's or, you know.
Yeah, that would be super,
they get to hang on.
Yeah. Well, then you're with everybody. You're mingled all the time. Exactly. Yeah.
Now, what about who was the GM there in the Yankees? Weiss still?
Weiss.
And I've heard stories about what a piece of work he was.
Well, you know, when I was there, I never, you know, when Topping and Webb had the club, we never saw him. Never saw him until they came down and congratulated everybody on winning. That's the only time, I swear to God. And the only guy the chief guy to me was Stengel, and Houck in 61, because they never came around.
Now I read another quote. You were talking about how in that 61 game, in the seventh game, or 60, is it 60, when Ralph Terry threw it right over the plate to Mazeroski. And then Stengel went out and talked to him.
Yeah,
and by the time the ball had been hit, he hadn't even turned around.
Yeah, he
knew.
Yeah, he turned. I was sitting in the dugout, and Casey had gone out because he threw him a high fastball or a high curve, I can't remember which. And that Mazeroski fouled it, took a swing, and actually came off the ground. And that Casey jumped out and went out there, and he talked to him, and he turned around. And he started back, and he got across the third base line, got a few feet, and he threw him another one. And it looked like the same pitch. And when he heard it, Casey never turned. I mean, never just heard the click of the bat, turned left, and started. And the picture, there was a picture somewhere, and I don't know if I've got it or somebody had it, shows Casey walking with the guy scoring, you know?
And you said that you thought maybe that might have led partially to Casey being fired or let go. They said he resigned, but he didn't really resign.
Yeah. I've heard another story about why we didn't start Whitey in that series.
What's that?
Well, that's what I'm saying. Whitey didn't start.
Right.
And
I'm mad about that.
And they started Ditmar, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know why, but I heard that kind of created some problems, probably for Casey too. I just don't know.
And then I'm trying to think what else I wanted to ask you. Oh, did you ever get? I noticed you were talking. You were talking about some fight. Did you ever get in any fights, personally?
Not personally. There was more of a breakup type stuff. No, we were in a couple of real dandy. We were in one big one with when Mario Fracano. I don't know if you remember when he hit Cass Michaels.
You know, oh, yes, I do. That was a beanball war. Didn't they hit two guys? They destroyed
them. That was the only time in my whole career that if you could have said, stop everything right here, I would have said, this guy is going to hit this guy in the head.
You saw it coming.
Oh, I think Kaz was in Chicago then. and we were playing for Canada's pitching. Michaels is batting sixth. The first five guys, I think, scored on base hits and whatnot. Here comes a guy now, first inning. And he had a closed stance. Kaz always stood closed like this. And I swear to God, you just stood there and looked, and here it come. He never moved. And he hit that, and had the little liner helmet then. Mm-hmm. And he hit that, and I thought a gun went off in that stadium. Man, he just dropped the ball, dropped right there. He just went.
Was he ever the same?
No. He died, actually kind of led to his death in about 2 years. He tried to come back the next year, but he was getting dizzy. And Kaz, you know, I played with Kaz a little bit, and just a sweetheart of a guy. And it was one of those things that Furcano had a pretty good temper. And he was just, you know, he was just getting the shit kicked out of him.
He was just mad.
And he was mad. And whoever was up there was going to get it. So then we played Detroit. Now, Kaz came from Detroit. And Steve Gromek and Keen, they were all great buddies. And Kaz was a great bowler. He could have been a pro bowler. So we're playing Detroit, and Keen's up, and it's Furcano's pitch, and he throws him right behind him. This Gromek comes up, because the pitcher's batted in those days in the American League. He hits Gromek, and that did it. Here they come. And I mean, that's when Dropo was there, and all, you know, Dropo. We had Zernial, we had Ray Murray, we had these huge guys that were all 6'4", 6'5". They were all out there trying to chop each other up. I'm not going to get in that mess. No way.
Now, did you ever get Bean?
I did. Barry Lettman in Chicago. Yeah. There was another case. We scored, I was leading off. I hit a triple to lead off the game. We scored. We go all the way around. Bob Grimm was pitching for us. Bob Grimm hits a home run, hits a grand slam home run. I'm coming up again. So I said, we're leading like 9-0. And we haven't broken a sweat yet. And Al Lopez was managing the White Sox. And I said, I'm going down. I mean, if this guy don't throw me now, you know. So I'm just standing there, and I'm going to take it. He throws him right down the middle. I sat there. I said, well, I guess he changed his mind. I step in, the next pitch, boom, coming right here, right off the back, off the top of the air. I would have the helmet on. And
how long were you down for?
They took me out of the game. They took me to the hospital. I was fine. I never lost consciousness.
Right? Did you think he did it on purpose?
Somebody
swinging a golf club.
It's a golf course.
What tee is that?
That's four, going back. Wow. Yeah, that's...
Have you ever had balls hit your house?
We've been here since 1960. We've had probably five.
Is that a good course there?
Beautiful.
Nice course. You play golf?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. I was a member here for almost 35 years.
Wow.
Yeah, I just got out about 4 years ago. Oh, they're getting crazy with this money stuff now.
Oh, I know.
And,
what a leg.
It's 80,000 now.
How much?
80,000
per year.
No, to join.
And then,
but it's like $600 a month. That's right. Before anything else happens. Before you buy stuff, you know, you're on retirement.
That's expensive.
It gets very expensive.
Now you get the pension from the major leagues.
I get a pension, right? And it's been pretty good. We fought a lot to get more for the guys back then. Mm-hmm. Guys like Early Wynn and them were really pushing. They mm-hmm. push like hell. They did a good job.
Yeah.
They got us more money.
And then what happened with the beer distributorship?
We sold it.
Did you?
Yeah.
When you retired from baseball, what did you do for the distributorship? Were you a salesman? Or?
Well, no. I my dad and I ran it.
Oh.
Yeah. And then he kind of got out because he had been in that business for a long time. And so he got a chance to play some golf and kind of retired.
I interviewed another Paisan, Ernie Broglio.
Oh, Ernie.
And he was saying that he got out of that business out of baseball, but he had to quit because he was drinking too much.
Oh,
he said he'd go out there and they'd want to talk baseball, and pretty soon they have a couple beers and a couple drinks.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
He said finally he went to them and said, "Put me in the warehouse." And they said, "Well, you're not going to be making as much money." He said, "I don't care. Get me out of the bars."
Yeah. That's easy to do, boy. Yeah. I like beer, but I could never drink beer that much. And these guys, when we'd go to these conventions and stuff, you know, these representatives from the brewery, I swear, they got hollow legs. They sit there and start drinking for hours, drinking beer.
And now, did you experience that very much with Mickey? And they talking about that now, how he didn't take care of himself?
Well, Mickey didn't take care of himself. That's a given, I'm telling you. He just didn't do it. But you know, the guy performed on the field, and it was amazing to watch him. I know there were days when he'd have rather been in bed or something, because he could hardly see. Mm-hmm. You know, he's like be bloodshot. But my God, he was an amazing young man, I'll tell you. And I would have loved to have seen him, you know, be physically fit and see just how good he was.
Yeah, he had his knee always. Oh,
he just suffered so badly with that damn thing. He wrapped it every day, but I tell you, he's still the best, one of the best players I ever saw, day in and day out. And I playing against him, I thought it was, but when I played with him, I was just amazed.
If you had to summarize your whole, I read, and I've been doing research on it. I read that most of the stuff I read was in that one book.
Mm-hmm.
They played the game or something?
Yeah.
They interviewed you and us.
Right.
Did you like the way that came out?
I think it was pretty good. Yeah, in fact, I was looking through some of the stuff that I had.
I love the part where you talk about, because I love to eat, and I love Italian food. I'm Italian. And I saw when you were talking about all the great places you used to go eat, and you said there was a place in Chicago, some place that served steaks and pizza. I guess you said you did a pizza ad for a while.
I did a pizza ad in Kansas City, there were certain restaurants that, you know, you picked out. Like there was one in Washington D.C. It was Rocco's.